The US reportedly carries out airstrikes on Iraqi forces in Barbe province, killing several people. Tunisian police clash with demonstrators as nationwide protests against the police and an economic crisis enter their third night. New poll shows Donald Trump's approval ratings has plunged to the lowest as he prepares to leave office. It's good to have you with us. Our top story this hour, Iran's ambassador to the United Nations has called on all the signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal to uphold their end of the bargain. In an interview, Majid Takht-Ravanchi pointed to U.S. obligations under the international accord and UN Resolution 2231, which endorsed the agreement. He said not only the U.S., but the European parties must also respect their commitments under the deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA. The Iranian diplomat said the administration of U.S. President-elect Joe Biden must lift all sanctions mentioned in Resolution 2231, adding that Tehran won't accept Washington meeting its obligations halfway.
Over the past few years, the U.S. has changed the name of some of the sanctions that were lifted under the JCPOA. For example, it has renamed the sanctions imposed on Iran's central bank. This is not our problem. It's up to the Americans to solve their problems. It's unacceptable for us to hear them say, we will comply with the JCPOA, but we won't lift these sanctions because they have been recategorized.
Takht-Ravanchi further said that Iran will go back to full compliance with its obligations under the deal once all parties do the same. The U.S. withdrew from the JCPOA in 2018 and reimposed unilateral sanctions on Iran. Tehran, in return, announced a gradual scale back of its commitments, citing the remaining signatories' failure to meet their obligations. Iran and the Republic of Azerbaijan have hailed the expansion of bilateral ties between the two neighbors. This comes during an official visit by Azerbaijan's Deputy Prime Minister, Shahin Mustafayev, to Tehran.
Both sides are satisfied with the results of the Iran-Azerbaijan Joint Commission. Both sides work together to create a vast cooperation in these new circumstances. The relationship between our countries has been extended in the past 7 years. We have had hundreds of meetings together and signed more than 40 agreements, strengthening our ties as neighboring countries.
The Iranian parliament has hosted an international webinar of parliaments that support the Palestinian cause. The event seeks to invite Muslim countries to unite against Israel's occupation of Palestinian lands and maintain their support for Palestine. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Quds, the axis of Muslims' unity. This is the theme of the international webinar of parliaments supporting Palestine. Organized by Iran's parliament, the event was attended by parliament speakers and deputy speakers from Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Yemen, Indonesia, and other Muslim countries, as well as representatives of Palestine's resistance movements to express their solidarity with Palestinians in their resistance against Israel's occupation. Delegates condemned Sudan, the UAE, and Bahrain for their normalization of ties with Israel, calling it a betrayal to the Muslim community.
It's a bitter tragedy to see that Palestinians' houses are demolished on a daily basis. 2 million Palestinians in Gaza are living in a prison-like area, and 5 million members of the Palestinian diaspora are not given their legitimate right to return to their homeland. What's even more tragic is that some Muslim countries have given the seal of approval to Israel's crimes by establishing political and economic ties with the occupying regime.
We call on the parliaments of all Muslim and Arab countries to take serious measures against the Israeli occupation of Palestine and especially the unwelcome deal of the century that seeks to change the identity of Palestinians and their land.
The Arab-Israeli normalization came as part of outgoing U.S. President Donald Trump's so-called deal of the century. The plan, which triggered a storm of condemnations from Palestinians, refers to Jerusalem as Israel's undivided capital and recognizes Israeli sovereignty over large parts of the West Bank. While the controversial deal was championed by Trump, Observers say the incoming U.S. administration is not likely to change course on Palestine.
For me as a Palestinian and the previous experience of all American presidents, they are, and especially Biden, he's having a big heritage of literature to support the security of Israelis. And he did nothing when he was the vice president during Obama's time for the Palestinian, except that speech and rhetorics, and we have gained nothing.
Palestinian ambassador to Iran says resistance remains the only way ahead of his people against Israel's occupation, since he believes that the path of dialogue does not work with Israel.
We have to unite our forces to be strong front, and all the Arabs and Islamic world will stand behind us. No other way, because they have proved always that they are not loyal to negotiations or to any other settlement with them.
Although the Arab-Israeli normalization infuriated the Muslim world, commentators say it should not come as a surprise, and it's only a revelation of their long-existing covert ties. This is why they believe the move will not lead to a seismic shift in regional power equations.
Delegates at the webinar underlined that Palestine remains the top priority and the innermost issue of the Muslim world, adding that Israel and its Western supporters have spared no effort in derailing that priority. They called on Muslim countries to stay united, as they believe this is the main counterforce against Israel's expansionist agenda. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Now, the U.S. military has reportedly carried out airstrikes on the Iraqi forces in the town of Jorf al-Sakhar in Barbil province. Iraqi media have reported several explosions in the town, saying the targeted area belonged to the Iraqi army. Three U.S. drones and a warplane were reportedly involved in the raid that left at least six people dead and several others wounded. There have been no immediate comments either from the Iraqi government or the U.S. military stationed in the Arab country. Tunisian police have clashed with demonstrators as nationwide protests against the police and an economic crisis enter their third night. Security forces used tear gas and water cannons to quell the protesters who were throwing stones, gasoline bombs, and burning tires in the capital, Tunis. The demonstrations began on Friday after a video went viral showing an officer pushing a shepherd whose sheep entered a government building. Police say they have arrested over 1,000 people involved in the rioting. The protests also followed the 10th anniversary of a popular uprising that pushed former President Zine al-Abidine Ben Ali from power. 10 years on, anger is growing at chronic joblessness and poor state services in the country. Meanwhile, President Kais Saied has asked people to stop violent protests, warning that some political forces are trying to sow chaos. Elsewhere, Guatemalan security forces have cleared a road blocked by hundreds of migrants, mostly Hondurans, on their way to the United States. Police forces, armed with batons and shields, dispersed the migrants who had camped out overnight on a road in eastern Guatemala. Minor clashes also reported there. A caravan with 8,000 migrants departed Honduras on Friday, but has been held up near the Guatemalan borders. The Guatemalan government says it cannot allow them to pass without travel documents or a negative coronavirus test. The Honduran migrants flee poverty and violence in a country hammered by the coronavirus pandemic and back-to-back hurricanes. Political commentator Life Malcolm says the United States is responsible for the poverty and corruption in Central America.
The United States could be held responsible and very well should be held responsible. The United States have had its hands in the corruption, the poverty, the chaos, the turmoil, and all the other disasters you can imagine socially in the Central American part of the world. The United States, as you know, instituted and facilitated a coup of the democratically elected president in 1954, Jacobo Arbenz, in Guatemala. And since that time, the United States has force Guatemala to be its watchdog, so to speak. And so when you have people like those families in Honduras scrambling for resources and looking to the United States as the place where they can get a piece of bread and maybe a coin or two, you have to trace that history back to the United States machinations in Guatemala and other Central American areas.
More bad news for the outgoing U.S. president. A new poll shows Donald Trump's approval ratings has plunged to the lowest as he prepares to leave office. According to a Gallup poll, a whopping 66% of Americans disapproved of the way Trump is handling the presidency. Just 34% of those surveyed approved of his job. Trump had an average 41% approval rating throughout his presidency, which is 4 points lower than for any of his predecessors. His role in inciting a violent mob that stormed the Capitol and a second House impeachment are reasons behind his dwindling popularity. The new poll comes just 2 days before President-elect Joe Biden takes office. Meanwhile, Trump is expected to issue around 100 pardons and commutations for his controversial allies and white-collar criminals during his remaining days. Elsewhere in France, the average daily coronavirus infections have hit over a six-week high, with more than 18,000 confirmed cases. Unlike Britain or Germany, the French government has stopped short of imposing a third national lockdown. However, a nationwide curfew remains in place to curb the surge in cases. France has so far reported over 70,000 deaths out of more than 2.9 million cases. Meanwhile, the UK has closed its travel corridors until February the 15th to curb the spread of a new COVID variant as Europe keeps struggling with a second wave of the pandemic. In Germany, the health minister says while the infection numbers seem to be decreasing, the country is still not stable.
We see both in the infection numbers, which seem to be going down where we look at the last few days, as well as the situation in the intensive care units, where there are 10 to 15% fewer COVID-19 patients now than at the peak. That seems to be moving in the right direction, but we are still a long way from where we need to be.
German authorities have registered over 7,000 new cases, taking the total of infections to over 2 million. The virus has also, so far, claimed more than 47,000 lives in the country. Elsewhere in Europe, Italy registered nearly 9,000 new cases and 377 more deaths. The country has logged over 82,000 deaths so far, the second highest in Europe. Portugal's daily death toll from the virus also reached a record high of 167 on Monday, bringing the total to over 9,000. The country has been under lockdown since last week, with hospitals struggling to cope with soaring contagion. Government debt continues to grow in the EU, and the bloc social crisis will deepen further. That is the stark assessment of Eurozone finance ministers who have held a video conference to talk about the impact of COVID-19. Jerome Hughes reports.
2021 has so far been miserable for millions of business people and their staff across the 27-country European Union. Lots of outlets are being forced to close their doors to prevent the spread of COVID-19, with only essential retailers allowed to remain open.
You see that we have stricter measures than even a few months ago all around Europe.
Finance ministers from the 19-nation Eurozone have just concluded their first meeting of 2021 and warned that social inequality in the EU has yet to peak. Government and personal debt is rising due to the pandemic. We are reminded that the bloc has pre-existing economic problems. For example, in Greece, youth unemployment was running at almost 50% even before COVID-19 came along.
Do not forget the situation in Italy where proper tax system is not in place and France is facing enormous problems of unemployment.
The EU's spending watchdog, the European Court of Auditors, has been examining the bloc's initial response to the pandemic. During an online interview, a spokesperson told us that better cooperation is required.
Indeed, the EU has to learn lessons going forward. What do react better to the COVID crisis, but indeed to pandemics in the future, because pandemics aren't going away. There will be another one in the future.
EU finance ministers say COVID-19 recovery funding needs to be released without delay and spent wisely by member states. Meanwhile, the bloc's crucial vaccination programme is being rolled out too slowly, many health experts argue. Because the bloc is still in the middle of a health emergency and the start of a new economic crisis, analysts say the EU's response will not be fully assessed by citizens until the pandemic passes. Based on current information, perhaps their verdict will not be good. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
And an independent panel has criticised China and the World Health Organization for their handling of the COVID-19 pandemic at the onset. The experts reviewing the global handling of the disease says China could have applied public health measures more forcefully to curb the outbreak at the initial stage. The panel, which is led by the former New Zealand Premier Helen Clark and former Liberian President Ellen Johnson, also slammed the WHO for not declaring an international emergency in January last year. The report came hours after the WHO said global deaths from the virus are expected to top 100,000 per week very soon. Meanwhile, scientists have concluded that the coronavirus infection may offer less protection against a new variant first identified in South Africa. Human Rights Watch has called on Israel to provide Palestinians with the coronavirus vaccines. In a statement, the international body said that the Israeli regime must ensure that vaccines are equally provided to the Palestinians in order to meet its obligations under international law. Asher Shannon has more in this report.
An international rights group says that Israel, as an occupying power, must provide coronavirus vaccines to Palestinians. According to a press release by Human Rights Watch on Sunday, the Israeli authorities should provide COVID-19 vaccines to Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Human Rights Watch Regional Director Omar Shakir said that while Israel has already vaccinated more than 20% of its citizens, including Jewish settlers in the occupied West Bank, it has not committed to vaccinate Palestinians living in the same occupied territory under its military rule. Israeli authorities had, as of January 14, 2021, provided doses of the vaccine to more than 2 million Israeli citizens. Close to 150,000 coronavirus infections and over 1,500 deaths have been reported in the occupied West Bank and the blockaded Gaza Strip so far.
Article 56 of the 4th Geneva Convention requires Israel as an occupying power to adopt and apply the prophylactic and preventive measures necessary to combat the spread of contagious diseases and epidemics. The provision of COVID-19 vaccine to Palestinians is the duty of the Israeli occupying forces. Israel bears full responsibility for the health and well-being of people under its occupation.
Palestinians have accused the Israeli regime of practicing medical apartheid against them and committing mass human rights violations. Experts say Tel Aviv must end its discriminatory policies and remove any barriers that may hinder Palestinians from accessing or enjoying health care.
The statement by Human Rights Watch echoes the position of many international human rights organizations as it exposes the ugly face of the Israeli occupation. It also exposes the grave human rights violation by the Israeli regime, especially violating the health rights of Palestinians. Israel, as an occupying power, must meet its obligations under international laws and norms.
Human rights groups are expressing alarm over Israel's decision not to vaccinate more than 4.5 million Palestinians living in the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip, depriving them of their right to health care.
Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Brings it into our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Joe Biden has selected longtime Democratic insider Samantha Power to lead the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID. Samantha Power has been an outspoken advocate of U.S. humanitarian intervention, promoting the Iraqi war and defending human rights abusers like the Israeli regime and Saudi Arabia. Dear listeners, please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Alan McLeod Ryder. This article is published under the heading Record of Hawkish Intervention. Biden picks Samantha Power to head USAID. Here's the details of this article. Joe Biden has selected longtime Democratic insider Samantha Power to lead the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID. There is simply no one better to ensure our development agenda is a core pillar of our foreign policy, the 87-year-old Delawarean said in a video statement, claiming that under previous Democratic administrations, Power fought tirelessly to prioritize human rights. USAID styles itself as a human rights organization, a Washington-sponsored group promoting democracy and development around the world. But if one delves deeper than merely the surface level, the organization has been crucial in financing a number of regime change operations across the globe. USAID money has been used to back opposition insurrections in Venezuela, Nicaragua, for example, while it continues to use its grants to provide leadership training for its preferred political candidates worldwide. Alan Weinstein, a co-founder of the National Endowment for Democracy, an organization USAID funds, told the Washington Post, "A lot of what we do today was done covertly 25 years ago by the CIA. Power's appointment was warmly endorsed by Biden's Vice President Kamala Harris. "One of the most pressing challenges facing our nation is restoring and strengthening America's global leadership as a champion of democracy, human rights, and the dignity of all people," she said, adding that few Americans are better equipped to help lead that work than the former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. Others were not sure. Journalist Glenn Greenwald wrote, "This is a good choice in the sense that, as the head of USAID, an agency ostensibly devoted to assisting other countries, Samantha Power can work to repair the damage to all countries she helped destroy the last time she was in government with her unhinged militarism." Power came to national attention with the publication of her book, A Problem from Hell: America and the Age of Genocide. The book was published in 2002 in the wake of 9/11 attacks and the invasion of Afghanistan and in a run-up to the Iraqi war. Unlike other critics of U.S. foreign policy, power castigated Washington for not intervening enough in other countries, arguing that the U.S. has a responsibility to protect the weak in the world. In general, Power supported the Iraq War, stating on television that an American intervention likely will improve the lives of the Iraqis. Their lives could not get worse, I think it's quite safe to say. Although, she criticized the Bush administration harshly for not effectively managing the conflict. She got her chance in government once Bush's years were over, being appointed to a number of positions in President Obama's State Department and National Security Council before being appointed ambassador to the UN in 2013. Power presents herself as someone who stopped genocide in Central Africa and was strongly in favor of military interventions in Libya and Syria for the same reasons. Yet, in her roles in the Obama administration, Power was a key promoter of some of the worst violence of the 21st century. Yemen is a clear standout example, described for years by the UN as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The Saudi-led onslaught on the country has led to 80% of the country needing humanitarian assistance, including some 20.5 million lacking access to clean water and sanitation, as Saudi planes target medical, water, and sewage facilities. As ambassador, Power defended Saudi Arabia from criticism and helped block international efforts to respond, even focusing the blame for the violence on Ansarullah movement. Yes, millions of Yemenis have died or been displaced due to the Saudi-led violence. Power has strongly defended the Zionist regime from criticism at the UN, despite the regime's bombing campaigns against the civilian population of Gaza. She excoriated the institution for their unequal treatment of the Jewish state and for their indefensible silence in response to terrorist attacks on Israelis, as she claimed. In her latest memoir, The Education of an Idealist, there is no mention of Yemen. Israeli regime attacks on Gaza or drone warfare subjects, she seemingly edited out of history for convenience. Her education already appeared complete by 2014, however, when she attended a baseball game with Henry Kissinger, one of the world's worst human rights abusers, and a man she had previously harshly criticized. 2 years later, she accepted Henry A. Kissinger Prize from the man himself, a sign that she had earned his respect and admiration. In a sense, Power could be seen as the perfect pick for the Biden administration, a woman who continues to use the language of human rights, but completely committed to the U.S. imperial project and is every bit as hawkish as her Republican counterparts. With groups close to the president already advising him to push for increasing tensions with Russia and China, Biden might have found the right person for the job.
Food for thought.
Salam, dear listeners. And here is food for thought for you regarding the Noble Quran as expounded by Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace upon her, the daughter of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. The Quran leads its adherents to goodwill, and hearing it leads to salvation. With it are the bright divine authorities achieved. His, that is God's manifest determination, acquired. His prohibited decrees avoided. His manifest evidence recognized. His satisfying proofs made apparent. His permissions granted. And his laws written.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, you are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we are going to look at some principles of upbringing children so that the audience gets a detailed description of the matter concerning how to raise their children Islamically. The main source is the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. And today we have in our studio guest speaker Sister Salma Khalfan, who is an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qum. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program, Sister Salma.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here as well.
Thank you for being here. So in our previous episode, we were talking about the outside influences that affect our child upbringing, because definitely it's not only at home that we upbring our child. They go outside, they go to school, they have programs. They definitely get these outside effects. So we were talking about how to deal with them, and we talked about the television and generally these technological advancements that have occurred. They definitely affect our children. So you're telling us more about that.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Yeah, I was talking about the television, and I say that there might be good things to this advancement also, but when it goes out of hand, then there are messages that are so effectively passed through the passage of the eye, the medium of the eye, so it'll remain in the child forever.
Yeah.
So what kind of messages are passed by, for example, children are bombarded with images of people seemingly leading fun-filled lives.
Mm.
You know, like their behavior, their clothing, their lifestyles are all totally opposed sometimes to Islam. So they feel that this is what life is when you're so happy. And look at them, the way they're dressed and the way they live and the way, you know, they go about their lives. This is what is life is.
Yeah, I remember when I was young, I used to wish I would live in the cartoon land because it's so much fun. It just seemed so much fun. Obviously, I was young at that time,
yeah.
But just generally having this idea of, you know, a lot of television, it limits the imagination because usually imagination is what you build. If you're given, constantly being given things to imagine about, it limits it.
Yeah, it limits it. And also it goes in the wrong direction of why this faculty of imagination was gifted and bestowed by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, right?
So maybe it's okay for a while, but, you know, not over.
Just so that, you know, you can make your gratify your children that, you know, if people have it outside, you're not missing too much of it.
Yeah.
You're doing your share, and children automatically would like to do other things more than watching the TV. They get tired of it. There are so many other ill effects of watching the screen, you know, that we are not talking about it. Mainly we are talking about the messages that the television passes, you know, across the child, because he uses the image of the sight to look at it, and that fills his imagination, which will give him the wrong kind of thoughts.
Yeah.
The way we said about looking at a program that are filled with such images that show that, you know, life is this piece of cake and this is what life is all about. When you're dressed like this and your clothing is like this and the way you behave is like this. This is what real life is. That's what makes you happy. So this gives the wrong kind of information to the child.
Also, there is something called instant gratification. I feel like right now, because of this technological advancements, parents, maybe they're tired from work, but I'm talking about, for instance, mothers who are at home. They need to a bit try and show more enthusiasm when they're doing other works, because usually you'll see if they're tired, they feel lazy, they feel like being on their phone. This causes the child to become a bit like that, and then they want to also feel happy and also want something. So TV is like an instant gratification. They don't need to do work, they don't need to play or make something, they just need to watch and feel so happy about it. So I guess also if the parents are not so, you know, they're too much on their phone or something, they feel like, okay, we also want, they get to be a bit lazy, but they also get what they want. So it's a bit of a, you know, difficult time to handle properly.
Yeah, that's right. Especially, you know, looking at the mood of children when they're watching TV. First of all, you should be very careful of how they watch it. They shouldn't be totally near the screen. And then when they're watching it, they shouldn't be lying down also, because that will give more of that feeling that they're just, you know, lazing around.
Yeah.
So always teach children to watch it with an intention and with a motivation, a learning. And always speak to the child so that he's not so much riveted in the just screen, you know. Speak to the child. Look what they're doing. You know, we should also try this.
Yeah, it's
things
true.
Like that.
Exactly.
So that the child is not so much obsessed with the television.
All right, so we're going to take a short break. Inshallah, we'll be back for more on this topic after the break.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear audience, to IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran, and this is Islamic Upbringing. So we were talking about how the television affects and how we can, you know, control it and how to deal with it now that we have it.
Another disadvantage of the television is the amount of violence it shows, especially if children, if you go and see, if you just give children any kind of cartoon to watch. In our time, there was Tom and Jerry to watch, and till now it goes on because it's so much funny But the messages it gives are very detrimental to a child. Because first of all, it teaches that you laugh at a person who is, for example, hurt.
Yeah.
This is a very bad message. Another, violence it shows, that you bang with hammers the head of the weaker people. You bang them so much, and then they come up again.
Yeah,
they
so like again. Nothing really happens to them. Don't worry.
Yeah, don't worry, exactly. Take it lightly. This is all part of life. And then another thing is that, for example, these all kinds of, you know, bad characteristics creep in them, like enmity and...
being mean, just wanting to hurt the other.
Taking revenge.
Yeah.
All these things are inculcated in the child from a young age. So all these things, you know, plays a very big role in the development, a proper development of a child. And, you know, there comes a time that the child feels that these are the funniest cartoons. And the good cartoons which you need show a child in his childhood, you'll feel them boring now.
Yeah, that's true.
So that's a very sad thing. So always, when you start showing them the television, what they feel like, for example. If they don't feel like, just leave it. That's the best thing ever. But some children feel like, let's watch the, you know, like this so-and-so cartoon because of the people around them. You know, the games, and now the life is like this, the technological advancements. Everybody knows of these things, yeah. You know, what program to come and everything. So if they, at all they want to watch, introduce them the good programs so that they can learn something. And as I said, that never let them be obsessed. First of all, see the way they sit and how far they sit and talk to them about it so that they feel that you are involved with them. It's not as if to leave them and do your work. Exactly. No. Unless you know that this is a repeated program that they will watch and they will learn the way they learned last time. That's a different thing. There are very many Islamic kind of cartoons that come that we feel very safe to leave our children. That even for us, limited time. So violence and all these kind of scary scenes of death and, you know, it makes them more emotional and makes them also more fearful and also makes them gives them a wrong kind of courage to try. Uh-huh. Such behavior,
yeah, it's true.
You know, like sometimes just showing a gun. If you go and see a small boy who sees kind of these violence games, will feel like taking a gun in his pocket and then showing a gun to the people, that hands up.
Yeah,
it's even just, if it's like that innocently, fun, yeah. Yeah. But it's not a good behavior. It shows that violence in you know, that grows in a child, that he feels that this is a cool thing to do,
that hard-heartedness that forms slowly.
It's very important to not expose with such programs to your child.
Yeah.
Very important from a young age.
And hence, like, for example, the Shuhada programs, the martyrs, for example, we over there, we're linking meaning to that. Not that you don't you're not here just killing for fun, or you're not just killing for the sake of it. No, over there was a reason, and hence why they're so, you know, great for us.
Yeah. So it's better to tell them like stories of such things rather than show them until they grow up, and now they can, you know, decipher properly. They can choose properly what is wrong and what is right. Very important at what age do you show them what and you tell them what. For example, about Karbala, it's all violence even in one picture of it. Tell them. But don't show them like this.
Yeah, they should understand it. Yeah,
they should understand it before they see it. For example, if they see it in form of plays or anything.
Yeah, thank you very much. We're just going to take a short break, and inshallah, we're going to continue this discussion. Stay tuned.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, "No father has granted a gift to his child better than good manners."
Welcome back to your audience, to IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran, and this is Islamic Upbringing. So we have been talking about the technological advances in this time and age, and one of them being television. And we've been talking about some of the positives and some of the negatives. Please continue.
Yeah, so all in all, I can say that television is good in an Islamic environment, an Islamic state, not even a Muslim state. That shows that the hijab is being performed. And even it couldn't be 100%, but still at least the 90% that we have, or the 80% that we have, limit it to a certain level that the child enjoys watching that, learns from that, and you are always, you know,
vigilant,
and besides that, the child, to share that this is important to learn a certain matter.
Yeah.
If it is something, then we are learning something from it. And otherwise, the TV should be shut down. Otherwise, the wrong messages can be got and wrong behavior can be formed in the process. So now I would like to look at the way books influence a child.
Yeah.
You know, although books have positives, of course, and positives outweigh the negatives, it's a sad thing that, you know, usually people replace it by now images, like looking at the television and everything. But books have a lot of role in the mental development of a child. A child, when they read, they imagine at the same time, and they're reading and they're improving their quality of their thinking and, you know, the brain effect.
Definitely.
And they become smarter. So, but the content should be looked at. What kind of books read? So we can't say that the content is always good, is it?
No.
So, and the pictures also, if we start from a young age, the pictures and the content all matter so much in the long run. So books are a great influence of a child, good and bad.
Yeah.
But we look at the way it influences badly to a child. Books play a great role in enhancing the intelligence of a child, of course. From a young age, children should be read to. First of all, they should be given this interest of books, that when we start reading to them, okay, we say that the child doesn't understand, so what to read to? But we should read to still, and that's how the interest will come.
Yeah.
That what is this, you know, that my parent is reading with so much interest, with actions and everything, so they will get this interest slowly.
And gradually.
Yeah, and gradually.
When I was young, I used to not like reading so much, but my sister used to love reading, and seeing her reading all the time made me like reading in the end. And now I love reading. So I guess it comes slowly.
Yeah, it comes.
For some people who don't like it.
Yeah, that's right. It's very good that you're surrounded by people who are, you know, love reading books and everything. Because sometimes, yeah, you feel that you'd rather just do it the fast way, watch something.
Exactly.
That's more fun. But the actuality is that the reading, it helps you so much and gives you so much more satisfaction, especially if it's the right kind of content that you're reading.
And like you said, we use a lot of imagination. So imagine if you're reading a book with not such good content, then you're imagining that bad content,
yeah,
which is so bad because you're forming the images by yourself.
Yes.
That's why reading the books with the right content is very important.
Very important.
Thank you very much. And inshallah, we are able to, you know, emulate and work on these factors that affect our children. Dear audience, thank you for joining us on the program. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir, and visit us at our website, parstoday.com. Inshallah, till the next episode, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
For weeks now, the UK has been hit with a record COVID-19 death rate. Apparently in the UK, the COVID-19 virus has mutated into a different strain, one that is much more powerful and a more transmissible strain. Matt Hancock, the UK's health minister, said a new variant of the virus is up to 70% more transmissible was getting out of control.
I understand they're coming down in November, but you could have predicted that they might be going back up again in 4 weeks' time. This is an extremely unpredictable virus.
Well, as you say, it's very unpredictable. And
why did you make that promise?
Well, it's very unpredictable because we understand, I understand, how important Christmas is to people who've been looking forward to it all year.
In England at present, some 17 million people are under Tier 4 rules. That's the highest level where people are being told to stay at home and not to leave the area.
And I'm off oxygen, feeling stronger all the time, you know. Still quite emotional. It's frightening.
People don't realise what's going on in here. If they don't see it firsthand, they won't know. They think everything's hunky-dory. It's not.
The dark red area, London and the South East, is in Tier 4 with the toughest restrictions because of the spread of the variant of the virus. Orange shows those parts of England in Tier 2, some of which are bordering that Tier 4 block.
Our political editor, Gary Gibbon, is in Westminster. Gary.
Well, on the specific problem of truck drivers being able to get into France, the government really does feel that an easing of that problem, if not a complete solution, is on the way.
To make matters worse, researchers in the UK believe that there are going to be even more difficult times ahead for Britons.
I think that we are in strict measures for some weeks to come. We absolutely need to try and get the R number below one, at least in most regions of the UK, and it's well above that now. So I think we need to recognise that January and well into February are going to be very difficult.
The number of people that have tested positive for the virus in the UK has increased to record highs despite the rollout of a vaccine. With the recent surge in COVID-19 cases, London began to reactivate its emergency field hospitals, known as Nightingale Hospitals, to cope with the crisis.
A realistic timeline that things will be much better by late spring. But of course, this is a global pandemic and we want to vaccinate in all countries of the world. So keeping an eye on international travel and how we move around the globe is going to be very important well into 2022, actually, just until we're confident about vaccination levels in a range of different countries.
Aside from the mutation of the virus, experts believe that there was also another underlying issue that has contributed to the high death toll there. The recent record UK COVID-19 death rate is being blamed on pre-existing inequality. Pre-existing social inequalities contributed to the UK recording the highest death rates from COVID-19 in Europe, according to a new report titled Build Back Fairer. The report is written by Michael Marmot, a professor of epidemiology at University College London, director of the UCL Institute of Health Equity, and past president of the World Medical Association. The report says that families at the bottom of the social and economic scale were missing out before the pandemic and were now suffering even more, losing health, jobs, lives, and educational opportunities. According to the report, men and women living in overcrowded conditions in the most deprived areas of the country are the most likely to die from COVID. Carers and those who work in the leisure and service industries have the highest death rates under the age of 64. People from Black, Asian and ethnic minority groups who work as taxi drivers, bus drivers, security guards, carers and other low-paid occupations have a higher risk of death. Children and young people living in deprived areas had suffered disproportionately from lockdown. Previous policy by the UK government have contributed to this inequality, including cutting the budget for Public Health England in 2012 by 40%, and the spending on public health in local government was cut by about $1.10 billion. This has compounded the dire situation in the UK. The UK never recovered from its first wave of the coronavirus. Millions have lost their jobs since the beginning of 2020. One in 20 people in the UK had already lost their jobs due to the coronavirus when YouGov conducted a poll back in April of 2020. Also, applications for Universal Credit, the government's benefit system, are sky high, with nearly 500,000 claims in 9 days as of last week. This has left many Britons forced to take handouts from charities to satisfy their hunger.
I had half a bag of rice and a tub of butter because I haven't been able to go out and do my food shopping. It's really helped me out because I was thinking, when's my next meal going to be or when am I going to be able to go out and get any food shopping?
Many are also left without money to pay their rent and now face evictions.
To come through this and then you don't suddenly stop wages coming in my account. I'm like, whoa, what am I going to do now? Landlord, what I want to say to landlord, you might keep me for 3 months. After 3 months, you ain't going to keep me. You kick me out. They ain't going to bother about this with coronavirus and stuff. You don't pay, you don't stay.
Now charities believe that there is going to be a lot more people in need of help as the new coronavirus strain takes its toll.
Going to see a lot more people that we never maybe considered as vulnerable before, now needing that food. And some of those people potentially were previously what was classed as the working poor. There were a lot of households where even though everyone in that household worked, they were still struggling to put food on the table. So to now not have that income means that we're going to see a lot of people in crisis that we just wouldn't expect to see before.
In fact, a report by the Public Health England published in August 2020 found that the COVID-19 was spreading faster in those living in the more deprived areas than those living in the least deprived areas. This means that these people who were in need are even more needier now, living in circumstances they wouldn't have thought of. This is especially true with the rising COVID-19 crisis there.
I mean, as we're going out and we're delivering the food, you can feel the desperation with some families that are so, you know, it's so needy at the moment. And things are only going to get worse as time goes on. I know that the self-employed are not going to get anything from the government until about June. I mean, what about those people? They're going to need food on their tables. I just think it's going to get more and more intense.
While it is too early to predict the true economic consequences of Britain's departure from the single market, already there are signs that the country's fragile food system will need to be rapidly updated in order to protect families, especially those on lower incomes. And now with Brexit, researchers expect tragic rise in food prices and increased inequality in the UK. The amount of food distributed by the charity organisation Trussell Trust, which runs around 1,200 of the country's 2,000 food banks, rose 73% in the past 5 years, with around 500,000 emergency food supplies going to children last year. Worst of all, inequality, the fundamental problem of the rising COVID-19 death rate in the UK, is growing too. Compared to other developed countries, the UK has a very unequal distribution of income. Almost a quarter of all household wealth in the UK is held by the richest 1% of the population, according to alarming new research by the Office for National Statistics, with data from the Sunday Times Rich List. The study reveals a historic underestimation of inequality in the country. As the country faces its biggest crisis since World War II, for millions of people, the government's financial aid will be too little, too late.